You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Thank you for coming back so promptly. We actually are more or less on time at the moment, and we will try to stay on time. Our third panel, I think, is going to be a very, very interesting one as well. It is going to focus on questions not only of economic interactions, but of course the energy equation, supply and demand, as it affects China's long-term development. At the same time, there are important strategic implications to the patterns of energy production and energy consumption, and very interesting stories here in terms of comparing the United States and China. Our panel today, if I could introduce them, to my farthest on the right, Charlie Ebinger, who heads the Energy Security Initiative here at Brookings, and will, I'm sure, give a very, very enlightening presentation. Ken Lieberthal is in the middle, although I should introduce Zhang Guobao to his left, only because the sequence we will go in will be Dr. Ebinger, then Zhang Guobao, and then Ken Lieberthal. But Zhang Guobao, of course, needs very little introduction. Vital role, former deputy head of the NDRC in China, centrally involved in the energy process in China. And I can assure you, having sat next to him at lunch, Zhang Guobao knows every number and every kind of production and need in the Chinese energy equation. And he wasn't even looking at a piece of paper. My colleague, good colleague and former head of the Thornton Center, Ken Lieberthal, who will try to draw out some of the strategic implications that will follow from the presentations that will precede him. So, without further ado, Charlie, do you want to sit from there or do you want to talk from here? Okay, good. Okay.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As he said, I am Charlie Ebinger, the director of the Energy Security Initiative, and I'm delighted to have the opportunity to share the podium today with our distinguished visitors and my professional colleagues here at Brookings. Since our guest knows every statistic on China known to mankind, I am not going to bother. What I've been asked to do is kind of talk about, well, the events of the last 10 years or so in China have led China to both make amazing strides in energy, but also have some serious constraints remaining in terms of the pollution arising from energy consumption and a host of other areas we'll hear about. I've been asked to kind of talk about, while that's been going on, the transformation that has been occurring in the U.S. energy situation, because I think many times people that don't follow the U.S. energy situation may be truly amazed. It is quite remarkable that when you think back to about 2008, the so-called shale gas revolution was hardly envisaged in the United States. Going back to just a few years before that, in 2005, we had predictions that within 10 years from 2005 that the United States would be importing 40% of our natural gas. Our crude oil production was continuing its historic decline. Our nuclear power program was in the doldrums. People were growingly concerned about emissions from coal, albeit we were passing environmental legislation to deal with that. We were actively pursuing renewables, and while they were growing in some cases faster in percentage terms than any other energy source, the reality is we remained terribly dependent on fossil fuels and incredibly dependent on oil and, in the future, projected natural gas imports. Nothing could be further from the reality today, because just in the last 5 years, the shale gas revolution has seen a transformation. The number of LNG plants, roughly 9 that we had built to import natural gas, now are all in line at various degrees of the regulatory process, asking the federal government to allow them to come export facilities. We have a whole another set of projects behind them, some absolute greenfield, meaning brand new projects, looking to become exporters of natural gas. And we have seen a dramatic reduction in coal emissions as natural gas has become so bountiful that it has replaced the natural gas has become so bountiful that it has led to the closing of a number of our more aged coal facilities. And ironically, as a country that did not sign the Kyoto Protocol, and a great criticism from our international friends and neighbors, as in my belief they should have been critical, we now find ourselves having basically met and perhaps even exceeded the targets for carbon reductions that we would have made had we signed the Kyoto Protocol. But this is not necessarily all good news, because while we're seeing in the short run tremendous benefits from cleaner burning natural gas backing out coal, we all know that in the long run, as we move towards a more gaseous economy, in the absence of proving that carbon capture and sequestration of both natural gas and coal is both commercially and technically feasible, if we can't do that, at some point we will see a rising trajectory of fossil fuel emissions and carbon emissions and other greenhouse gas. But we are now in a tremendous changed posture. We have gone from coal accounting for just under 50% of our electricity pretty steadily over the last number of years. That is now down 33-34%. Roughly, coal and gas are now pretty much equivalent in electricity generation. We have the prospect in the near term, albeit it will be a slow transition, of seeing natural gas very likely. We begin to replace the diesel fuel that we use in our 18-wheel trucks for long-distance freight across the country. Replacing this diesel will obviously further reduce the U.S. demand for petroleum, which will be good news for the rest of the world. Whether we can replace the 2 million barrels a day, roughly equivalent, that we use in diesel fuel and trucks over what period of time, one can debate. But it is a process beginning to happen. Major corporations like Cummins, GE, and others are investing in the technology, as they are investing in technology to make our locomotives run on LNG. Again, backing out diesel fuel, and we also see the prospects, albeit with some real institutional obstacles, of natural gas beginning to replace diesel fuel in marine transportation on our Great Lakes, our coastal waterways, and our major rivers. So we see the prospect of natural gas becoming a much greater fuel source. And this is not only going to occur in the United States. It has the prospect, albeit with some sharp differences I'm sure we'll hear about, in China. There's large promise of shale gas in places like Argentina, South Africa, Algeria, ironically in France, but the French don't want to develop it for fear that it might hurt their wine industry. I like the prioritization of industries there, but the point is there is large-scale shale gas in Russia. This is a transformation. But it's not just the natural gas story that's been transformed in the United States. We also, using much the same technology that has allowed us to break up the rocks in which this natural gas is trapped, a process called fracking, is now extended to the unconventional oil universe. So that for the first time, we are, with the exception of 1 year in the last 30 or so, we have seen a continual decline in U.S. oil production. We now see U.S. oil production rising, and rising quite dramatically. No one would have believed just several years ago that we would be producing just under 1 million barrels a day in North Dakota, of all places. But as we look towards the future, I think we can see the prospect easily of another 2.5 to 3 million barrels a day of oil production in the lower 48 states going up. We also, of course, controversially, but we also are deeply involved, of course, in the heavy oil sands in Alberta, which also have the prospect of rising dramatically. This is the whole part of this, is the whole controversy over the Keystone Pipeline that will bring that oil to the United States, and many environmentalists are, of course, adamantly opposed to that development. But right on track, we see now the prospect, the very real prospect. People argue about whether it's 10 years, 12 years, 15 years, but we see the prospect that North America, and notice I say North America, will be, for all intents and purposes, energy independent. We will, of course, continue to import from our friends to the north in Canada, but we are also beginning to see a fledgling energy revolution in our neighbor to the south, in Mexico, with changed policies that after nearly 50 years of not welcoming the international energy industry, beginning to at least talk about bringing the international energy industry in as partners, no sense of privatizing the long-established strong governmental role in Mexico, but at least working in partnership with international oil and gas companies. And if this comes to pass, I think we will see a situation where it truly is a North American energy independence involving the United States and our two neighbors to the north. So in the interest of time, let me just conclude by saying I think we're on the cusp of a transformation, certainly of the U.S. and North American universe, but this has profound implications for our friends in China and elsewhere in Asia. Because if one looks to all the forecasts for the growth in world energy consumption over the next 10 to 15 years, it is clear that the vast bulk of Middle Eastern oil and gas demand will shift to Asia. Principally, of course, to China, also to India, Japan, but China and India will be the two biggest claimants for this enhanced oil flowing from the Gulf. And what role that portends for China in its foreign relations with the nations of the Gulf, what role it portends for China and India, hopefully in partnership rather than rivalry for access to those vital resources, who guards the sea lanes. I will argue, I know this is controversial, and my colleagues at Brookings will take strong exception, many of them, but I would argue when the United States finally gets serious, hopefully we do someday, about our budget deficit, and a congressman or woman has to choose between food stamps for their constituencies or another aircraft carrier for the Gulf, I think I know which one they will choose. But others at Brookings say our strategic posture will not change because of other vital interests we will continue to have in the Gulf. So thank you very much. I hope that will place in context what is happening in the broader world market, and now we'll concentrate on what is the thrust of our discussion today, namely the tremendous energy challenges and opportunities facing China.
It's my pleasure to have an opportunity to join this conference. Brookings is so famous in China, well known in China, but it's a pity, it's my first time to visit Brookings, so I'm still nervous. I never studied English in the class all by myself, really. So I can't speak English so fluently. I still want to use the Chinese. But when I participate in the international forum, I find most foreigners can't use the iPhone. But if today you really want to listen my what I said, please use this iPhone. If you can't understand the Chinese, it's okay? 好,下面
So next I'll continue with English because I feel better expressing myself in English, in Chinese. So energy has always been the important topic in the international economic activities. And the Secretary of State, Kerry, who visited China recently, he said that he actually gave a speech at one of the energy panels, which I helped organize. And in the U.S.-China Energy Cooperation and Dialogue Forum, that's the platform where he gave the speech. This, to a certain extent, reflect the importance the U.S. government attaches to energy, to the issue of energy, especially for the cooperation in energy field between the two countries. I have also used a phenomenon called a butterfly effect to describe the interactive impact on each other in energy. Everybody knows about the theory. You know that in the eastern atmosphere, if a butterfly flips its wings, there will be a storm in the western hemisphere. So in the area of energy, it may not be a really swarm. However, whatever happens in western hemisphere will impact the eastern hemisphere. So in recent years, energy actually is an area where we have seen a lot of changes. As it has been mentioned, They talk about the efficiency of energy in North America. We know that in year 1973, when the first oil crisis took place, the United States put forward this concept that would be an effort to actually try to reduce the reliance on the Middle East oil, which some countries use as a weapon. However, because of the huge demand for energy by the United States, so even after so many years, it's hard to have self-efficiency, self-sufficient supply of energy. However, we can see the United States has made significant progress in that direction. So based on the numbers that I know, 2005 is the year when the United States imported the largest amount of oil. Because of that year, the daily import of crude oil is over 13 million barrels. Mm-hmm. However, to last year, that's the year 2012, the import of the daily import is only like 10.65 million barrels per day. The self-sufficiency actually in the year 2005 reached 69%. So that means the reliance on foreign oil is 31% in terms of total energy demand. So in last year, that number has increased to 81%. So the foreign reliance has thus decreased to 19%. So at the same time, in the year 2005, when China imported 146 million tons of oil. However, in 2001, it's over 270 million tons of oil imported by China. So that means there is an increase of over 100 million tons every year. So in the international energy supply, people see clearly that in the past years, the increase in energy consumption is mostly in the developing countries, and then again, mostly in China and India. That's self-evident. For the supply of for United States to improve the self-sufficiency energy supply, as the previous speaker said, actually has benefited from the new technology in shale gas. The production of shale gas last year in the United States, I believe, is 180 billion cubic meters. So the output actually passed the entire consumption by China. So last year, China consumed, in terms of natural gas, is 140 billion cubic meters, including about 100 billion produced in China, with the rest imported through either LNG or pipelines from overseas. Because of the success in shale gas and the increase of the supply of shale gas, therefore, in the U.S. market, so the natural gas is very cheap.
The price for one MMBTU was only $2.2. A few days ago, David Sandro, the Deputy Secretary of Energy, came to China and asked him about the price for MMBTU. He said it's now close to $4 per MMBTU. And so there's a slight rise, but I don't know. The numbers can be debated because we have other experts here today, so maybe we can check on this number. Now, in the Asia market, in Japan, it would be $16 to $18 per MMBTU. In China, basically, it's about the same for China. So very close to $15 per MMBTU. And when in Europe, it's $9.1 per MMBTU. So these numbers tell us one thing, that the natural gas in the United States is the cheapest in the world. So about 3 months ago, I asked Mr. Sandoz. Now, if the natural gas is so cheap in the United States, how do you make money? Or are you suffering from losses? He said, I think we're losing money. Well, then, if you're losing money, why do you still want to produce it? Well, he says, well, your steel in China is also losing money. Why are you producing it too? Well, because you already have the economy of scale, but then we do not have the enough facilities for exporting it. I know that in the U.S., along the coast, you have had 16 terminals, container terminals. You're hoping to receive LNG from Qatar of the Middle East. But once the terminals are built, before you had a chance to receive the LNG from Qatar, you're already able to lower the price of the LNG. So how are you going to transfer or convert these terminals into terminals for other type of fuels? So we want to see whether Chinese and other people are trying to hope to buy LNG from the United States. I said it's not possible in the next few years. And I also asked this Deputy Secretary of Energy, I said, so how many cases or applications you have not approved? He said, we still have 16 applications which are now stacking up on his desk. Only one has been approved, which is Korea. So, but I have not approved, he said, I'm not approved the other applications. Now, even if I approve all of them, because, for example, all these manufacturers or producers of LNG had also put a lot of pressure on the Department of Energy and said, why don't you allow us to export because it sells so well in Asia? But for the United States to convert this terminals for importing LNG to exporting LNG, you need certain kind of equipment that would take 3 years to build up. And so even if you have the intention to do that, it might take a little bit before you have time to export your natural gas to the markets in Asia. So this kind of butterfly effect, I think, has a lot of repercussions. For example, Now, you are not importing as much from Canada as you used to do before in the past. Natural gas from Canada was so popular, they didn't even care about selling it to Asia. They could just sell it to the United States, but now United States is not getting so much from Canada anymore. Now it has to think about other options. And so even if we can sell the U.S. because it's so cheap, but it's so cheap, so the best way to go is to sell it to the Asian markets. And so now Canada is more interested in selling natural gas to Asia markets than it used to do before. And then also Qatar, I remember when I was still helping the Guangdong province to negotiate on importing natural gas, and then we were considering Qatar, but then we didn't do it. We imported from Australia because at the time our production capacity is still low. But now, the production capacity has gone up. And then South Korea also have all these tank containers or oil tankers. Why they want to export the natural gas to the United States. But United States does not need it anymore. So now they are seeking markets in Asia and in Europe. Now, all this fleet of all these oil tankers are not completely consumed. So they are there having a sand bath, as we would say in China. So now Europe has a lot of options. They can buy from Russia natural gas. They can buy from Qatar. They can also buy from other places. And so now the Europe has, because it's a big buyer, so now it has more chips in its negotiations. So every year the price of natural gas going to Europe from Russia is going down. Now, the Deputy Secretary of Energy also came to China another time, and someone said in the delegation that recently President Xi Jinping visited Russia, and Russia has agreed to build pipelines to send natural gas to China. And this American said, it says that China needs the natural gas from Russia. I said that, but Russia also needs China. to export the natural gas, because the natural gas goes to Europe where the market is shrinking, so it also needs China. So not just that China needs them, so these are all the repercussions or the results of the butterfly effect as created by the United States. Now, within the United States, because of the great production of shale gas, our gas price here in the United States is going down, so that coal, the price of coal is becoming less competitive. So last year, when the United States exports 40 million tons of coal to Europe, making Europe the second largest coal consumer behind China. So Europeans who talk about cutting down on emissions, now they are more quiet on this particular topic. Now, China is so far away geographically. It's an ocean away from the United States. I never would have thought, imagined that we would actually buy this cheap coal from the United States across the ocean. I can't believe that we actually imported last year 5 million tons of coal from the United States. Again, this is another result of the butterfly effect. In Europe, the European Union, when they negotiate with Russia on the natural gas, and there are always a lot of conflicts in the negotiations, and now Europe has a lot of options, and now it can haggle or bargain better with Russia because now it has many options now. So Russia, in order to protect this market, not only it has built this South pipeline, it's also talking about the Nord Stream pipeline. They are working on these two projects together. These are pipelines that they've been talking about for a long time, but because of different opinions and conflicts, so these two projects will not be able to be launched. But under this backdrop, now Europe is in a better position to negotiate, and Russia is afraid of losing this European market. So now it has started to construct the South Stream pipeline. So all these changes around the world all have to do with the massive production of shale gas in the United States. Now, Russia also wants to send natural gas. It's just a design. It's something that they are proposing, that they can build pipelines eastward into China. So it means that Russia is taking the Chinese market very seriously as well. Another result, another butterfly is in Japan. In 2011, we have the Fukushima accident, which actually, Japan wants to have a revival of the use of nuclear energy, but because of Fukushima's accident, everything changed. And a lot of countries are also falling behind in terms of using nuclear energy, and some countries actually have given up nuclear energy usage completely, so all the stock prices on this nuclear energy has also gone down. And Japan has over 50 nuclear plants, but they have closed down all 56 of them because of the accident. And they really had a power shortage in Japan, and because of that, they restore two sets. So of the 56 reactors, 54 of them are not in operation. Only two are in operation in Japan right now. So what are they going to deal with a power shortage? So now they import a lot of LNG, causing the price of LNG in Asia to go up, which is now about $16 to $18 per MMBTU, which is another result of the butterfly effect. So I think energy landscape in the world is really changing, and all politicians who care about this matter, or ordinary people care about this. They said that now the U.S. is less dependent on the oil or fuel from the Middle East. And then so China is now more dependent on this energy. So now China should also take responsibility in protecting the sea lanes and all that. I think all people who are researchers and, you know, politicians will all talk about this. But I think the United States is moving towards a big step, taking a big step to move towards energy independence. However, Middle East is still a very important strategic location, a geographical location for the United States and also for importing crude oil. So I read an article in preparation for this talk. Even though when I did mention that the U.S. is dependent less and less on outside energy, but the U.S., on the contrary, is depending more and more on importing crude oil from the Middle East. So, I feel that under this backdrop, I think the whole world is actually paying attention to the future of renewable energy and a new energy. And I think this is an inevitable trend. Someone is telling me to stop talking, so I'm ready to stop talking, so here I am. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's a real pleasure to be on this panel. The previous two speakers covered so much. I've been sitting here wondering what I might contribute to this. Let me seek to make a contribution in the following way. We've heard a lot about the energy revolution in the United States. We've heard a lot about, I know more about butterflies and their effect now than I ever thought I would know. But seriously, a lot about the almost unintended repercussions globally of this kind of fundamental change in U.S. energy production. Let me focus, if I can, on the strategic implications for U.S.-China relations of the energy revolution in the United States and its ripple effects, because energy is really a truly strategic issue. And it has, in a lot of ways, affected U.S.-China relations in the past and will in the future. So let me kind of focus on several dimensions of that. As we've heard, you know, there's been a U.S. shale gas revolution and also a revolution in tight oil, and so in oil production in the United States, so that within a few years, there will be no U.S. direct energy imports from the Persian Gulf, a really dramatic change at the wake of many decades of substantial dependence on energy from that area. It also means there's greater competitiveness for U.S. domestic manufacturing, especially in industries such as petrochemicals. And we are beginning to have, and this will I'll get into this in a little more in a moment, but a potential substantial U.S. impact on international prices for natural gas. And we are already having a significant impact on U.S. Combustion of coal for energy purposes and therefore on U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. So there's a whole lot going on here within the United States. So with that as background, let me focus on two strategic issues in U.S.-China relations that are directly impacted by this energy revolution in the United States. The first is the issue of climate change. Climate change, I will show my bottom line very clearly, I hope that all of you agree with me, is existentially one of the most important issues the world confronts. It isn't the most important for tomorrow or for next month or next year, but as we look to the long-term future, it is hard to imagine an issue with such wide-ranging and consequential impact over time. This issue, though, is one that has been extremely hard to handle politically in the United States, also in China, and in many other countries. It sets up badly for political resolution. It crosses political boundaries, doesn't respect sovereignty or boundaries of cities or states or whatever. Its cause and effects are separated by very long periods of time. So if a political leader is going to do something about it now, it is, you know, the successor's five terms subsequently that begin to reap the benefits of those investments. Fossil fuels are at the core of the issue, but every major government is built around fossil fuel interests because those interests have driven every major economy as they've developed over time. And even as we anticipate the increasing impact of climate change, where the science is weakest is on determining the geography of that impact, what specific areas will get more rain or less rain or this or that. So global impacts are clear, but the specific geographies are not, and of course we're organized politically around geographies. So all of that has made this a very difficult issue to manage, and neither the U.S. nor China has managed it well. But the U.S. and China do share one thing, and that is that we are the two largest greenhouse gas emitters in the world, with India coming in third. So we are, the whole world now puts us in the same category, not one developing country and one developed country, but the two biggest emitters in the world, with another developing country, India, catching up rapidly. It's in this context that shale gas becomes important in a variety of ways. Shale gas, as one of our speakers commented, emits about half of the CO2 when burned that its coal equivalent emits. U.S. coal consumption is therefore going down, and U.S. greenhouse gas emissions are going down. Part of the coal that we are not, while our coal combustion is going down, our coal production has remained very high. And the difference, of course, is we become a major coal exporter, partly to Europe, but also to China. So that the impact net of greenhouse of use of more natural gas in the United States has not been as dramatic on greenhouse gas reduction as one would have hoped. We're taking our high greenhouse gas fossil fuel and simply sending it to other places to burn. Given the way climate change works, that is not helpful, let me say. Now, China has very large shale gas reserves, estimated to be recoverable reserves, estimated technically to be about 1.5 times the size of those in the United States. So China is, in at least in theory, positioned to have a shale gas revolution fully the equivalent of that in the United States, or perhaps even more dramatic than that over time. Using a climate change framing for the issue, it is enormously in America's interest that that shale gas revolution occur in China. It will produce the kinds of reductions in greenhouse gas emissions there, with potential spillover effects elsewhere, that will benefit us all. There are two dimensions to that issue, shale gas between the United States and China now, to my mind. One is whether China can acquire the technology that we have developed so rapidly to apply it in China. And the answer is, frankly, is not easy. And it isn't only because of concerns about intellectual property protection, which is what most people tend to think of. That's actually the minor part of it. It's in part that China's shale gas deposits are generally much deeper underground than American deposits are. Secondly, fracking, which is key to exploiting a lot of these reserves, is very water intensive, but a large part of China's reserves are in parts of the country where there is no water to spare, where the water cannot be used for this purpose in requisite quantities. So you have to develop an approach to fracking that is not water intensive, and while there is research on that, that is not available at this time. And then thirdly, I'm told by people in our industry that even if you transfer the technology, the key in shale gas, in the shale gas revolution and fracking, is the engineering well by well. That this is very, very particular. We have about 100 engineers in the United States who can really do this stuff. And it will not surprise you to know they are all very well employed and enjoying their incomes. Right? No one wants to move to China in that group. Right? So I'm serious. So this is not simply a matter of China buying into, for example, Chesapeake, which is a major shale gas producer in the United States, in part to acquire technology. You need to acquire the specific engineering capabilities to operate in a very different environment. Plus, you have to have the resources such as water to be able to do this. And so it's going to be a long time before China is really in the midst of its own shale gas revolution. But it is in our interest to accelerate that process as best we can and to figure out ways to try to make that happen. The second element of this is for natural gas to replace coal as much as possible in China's energy mix. And if China isn't producing itself, certainly there is a price element to this that's very important. What I don't think came out clearly in the presentation to this point is there's, in fact, an enormous debate in the United States about whether we should export natural gas. It seems like a no-brainer. Our prices are low. Our production is more than we need. There's money to be made out there, and there are all kinds of good spillover consequences. Those who oppose that are those who benefit most from very low prices of gas in the United States, such as the petrochemical industry. So, in fact, there hasn't been a firm political decision made to make the huge infrastructure investments necessary and make the regulatory changes necessary in order for us to become a major shale gas exporter. But if we were to do that, China would be primed to buy, and this could have a significant substitution effect, which would help bridge from now to when China is producing its own shale gas. So we have two opportunities here. One is in working with the Chinese to accelerate their own capacity to develop their shale gas deposits, and then the other is to adopt the changes necessary to put a lot of American shale gas on the international market, a fair percentage of which will actually find its way into the Chinese energy structure. Let me shift to the other area. You know, and that's all good for climate change and helps to put the U.S. and China on the right side of that issue, or more toward the right side of that very important issue. The other strategic issue here is in the Middle East. And I define the Middle East as including the whole Persian Gulf. As has been noted, within a short period of time, maybe 5 years or so, the U.S. will no longer take any energy directly from this region. We will nevertheless maintain very strong strategic interests in the relatively free flow of reasonably priced energy out of the Gulf. Our allies and friends around the world depend on that, especially the Japanese and South Koreans. In addition to that, oil is a global commodity. The price of oil goes up elsewhere. It goes up in the United States. So it isn't like we have no interest there. We retain substantial interest. But I think, frankly, the chances of our fighting another oil war go down dramatically if we are no longer directly getting energy out of that region. China now gets more than 50% of its imported energy out of the Middle East. It's tried like crazy to diversify, and it still gets more than 50% out of the Middle East. My understanding is that will go to well over 70% within a decade, assuming ongoing efforts to diversify. Okay, so essentially, you know, given availability and prices and everything else, that's where most of the energy is going to continue to come from. I'm sure that Minister Zhang Guobao will correct me if my numbers are wrong here, but that's my understanding. So as the U.S. dependence on Middle East energy, direct dependence, is going to zero, China's dependence is becoming truly strategically fundamental. Okay. But if you look at the security situation in the Middle East, despite the U.S. conclusion of the war in Iraq and determination to basically end the war in Afghanistan by the end of 2014 with just a small residual presence there, nevertheless, U.S. military capabilities in the Gulf region will be by far the largest and most effective of those of any outside power in the region over the coming decade. You have to look at our base near Bahrain and all the. But fundamentally, we're going to have more power there, external military power, than anyone else will. My sense is that the Chinese PLA will not have the military capability to shape any outcomes in the Middle East in the coming decade. It is still building, but it is a long way from having that level of force projection capability. So we have a lot that is shifting in the Middle East. China is becoming involved because of its investments in a way that it has not been involved before, where it cannot rest on statements of principle and encouragement of everyone to solve problems. It is becoming an active player in the issues of the region. The U.S., which has long been an extremely active player, will remain engaged, but not with as strong a direct interest as we have before. I think this highlights one of the fundamental realities of the U.S.-China relationship, which is as China's footprint has become increasingly global, third areas of the world, especially the Middle East is one of the prime examples, become areas that become integral to the nature of the U.S.-China relationship. And we need to figure out how to work more effectively together in the Persian Gulf area, in the mix of security, diplomatic, and economic strategies that we're pursuing in order to maximize the chances of ongoing stability and ongoing uninterrupted flow of energy out of that region of the world. And in that, I would argue also India should become part of the equation. So in conclusion, the energy revolution in the U.S. is having impacts of a truly strategic nature, potentially on U.S.-China relations. Neither side, I think, at this point has fully thought these through, and neither side has effectively engaged on them, although we have begun the conversation on both the Middle East and on shale gas and on climate change. These energy issues are now at the center of the major areas in which the U.S. and China can elevate their cooperation. You've all heard comments recently about the notion of developing a new type of major power relations between the United States and China. To my mind, that new type of relations has to extend to include, in a central way, our ability to do what we have not done before in terms of cooperation on these vital energy issues. And so I look forward to our two governments hopefully engaging on that along with our corporate sectors and scientists. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken. I think all three speakers have done a very, very effective job of capturing they've done a very... Am I hooked up yet?
No, I'm not.
I'm not wired for sound here.
Jonathan was saying that we've done a wonderful job.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Well, I think you can actually hear me even as we're waiting. You know, what strikes me is how you cannot think of either the United States or China in isolation here. That's obvious, because those worlds intersect. If the United States has both increasing energy production, diminishing need for foreign resources, it's over time, I would argue, probably going to be much more prepared to export energy. I know that that's not something that the United States is really presently undertaking, but it seems to me the inexorable trends here are very, 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 very obvious long term. There's no reason to believe that China's energy requirements are going to diminish meaningfully. Quite the contrary, they are going to increase significantly. And this has impact not only on the geographic focus of where China seeks to meet its energy needs, but on a whole host of other consequences, including, obviously, questions for China's production of greenhouse gases and how much those will increase. That production will increase over time as China's development continues. In addition, the impact of China's growing energy usage domestically in terms of environmental conditions in China is profound. China is going to have an inescapable need, in my view, to find ways to address what is obviously a crisis in China's cities and the expectations of China's own citizens for fundamentally clean air, quite apart from clean water and safe food. This is something people experience every day. It's not something that is unfamiliar to them as they deal with these consequences. So Charlie Ebinger's point at the outset, I think, could not be more true. None of us would have anticipated these kinds of developments even two or three years ago. It's really a remarkable phenomenon that the world does not stand still in these areas, and that technological breakthroughs have enabled a very, very different kind of energy equation, one which, as Ken noted, will find the United States not in need of energy resources from abroad, ultimately. And even the presumption that North America as an energy unit, if we could call it that, will be in some sense energy independent. When I think back about how often these goals were propounded, beginning with President Nixon, and often people would almost laugh at the prospect, but that day now seems to be arriving. So how these factors intersect is something that I hope we can have a bit of a discussion with here, both in terms of the panelists and also the audience as a whole. But I'm wondering, since on this panel we have three Americans and one Chinese, and that whether Zhang Guobao might want to make some observations about, rather than China and the United States being in the same energy boat, we are headed in very, very different directions. Do you think, Minister Zhang, that this argues for increased American Chinese collaboration with the United States, or do you see possibilities of a more conflictful future as a function of our different kinds of energy needs? I'm wondering if you might want to make a comment on that.
China and the United States are the two greatest energy-producing countries and also the biggest consumers. So in terms of the amount, there's not a lot of difference. But in the past, we were far behind. United States was number one. But right now, in terms of total production and consumption, I think both neck and neck. Maybe China is a little... is even a little bit bigger. So in terms of the power generation capability, China is also neck and neck with the United States. So in the energy area of the entire world, the two countries, United States and China, have to have close cooperation. And many researchers, scholars, and politicians who visit China, and sometimes we have meetings. One of the issues we talk about is energy governance, the global energy governance. They believe that the previous structure is no longer fit for the current energy situation, because in the past, there's International Energy Agency, IEA, that was actually set up after 1973 when there was the first oil crisis. It consists of the OECD members. So that forum actually is dominant in the energy affairs of the world. But right now, people are beginning to realize that IEA, which consists of mostly OECD countries, they cannot represent the interests of all partners in the entire world. For example, in Libya, when there has been this political turmoil, IEA actually came to China. And it said that in order that the Libya conflict would not cause the price rise in the international market, OECD countries will actually tap the oil reserve. Even though China was not a member of IEA, was not a member of OECD, however, there was still the hope that China would help coordinate. They knew that China didn't have a lot of reserve, but China would do at least some gesture in support of this action. So therefore, in the current world, without the participation of developing countries, it's hard to say that would be the correct evaluation of the world situation. So right now, a lot of people are discussing the new energy governance structure. So some people say, would it be possible to have a mechanism under G20? Well, there were people who said before that maybe we should use the framework of G8, but then they said that would be too small. Well, we should actually use the framework of G20. Based on the IEA, we should invite China, India, and Brazil to participate to talk about the issues. Between China and the United States, there have been a lot of cooperations. During lunch, I actually had a talk with some of you that and United States has 104 nuclear reactors. Even after Fukushima accident, and the conclusion was that all the 104 reactors are safe. China has only 16. And nuclear energy consists less than 2% of the power generation in China, and that of the United States is bigger. So China consumes a lot of coal, and that has to do with the energy structure of China. Because in developed countries, nuclear provides about 15% of the power generated, and China has less than 2%. So even with the impact of Fukushima, China will still explore actively to expand nuclear power generation. And what we're doing is to import advanced technology, the third generation technology from the United States, which the United States actually created but never put it into practice. So therefore, there will be a bright future for cooperation between the two countries, even in the areas of new energy. In new energy resources, there have been unpleasant events, for the investigation on the solar energy industry, and also increase the tariff barrier for import of solar energy from the from China. But in terms of wind power generation, you know, some windmills, some hardware has been exported by China to the United States. We know that a lot of actually private companies are investing in the a power generation, like wind generation or some others, and they take an active part in the new energy exploration. So in this area, I believe the two countries can cooperate. And Secretary Kerry, when he was visiting China, actually arranged a small exhibit. Over 60 energy companies in the United States organized a position called ECP. And China actually gathered some other energy companies. Secretary Kerry visited all the exhibits, and they talk about let's not only just show the pictures or some exhibits, but you better have something more concrete. And he asked a lot of questions. I believe he was impressed. So the cooperation in energy between China and the United States is being expanded and deepened. Thank you.
This didn't fit in the topic of our session, which was about shifting global energy supplies in U.S.-China relations. But the areas, as Chuck Guobao just highlighted, for U.S.-China cooperation in greater development of clean energy and in the use of energy in ways that are more climate-friendly, the areas of potential cooperation are enormous. One of the biggest, to my mind, and one that has not, that is still in its very early stages, concerns carbon capture and sequestration in the coal sector. When you burn coal to produce power, there is a major problem of greenhouse gas emissions, primarily CO2, mm-hmm. and there is technology to capture that CO2 and then either sequester it permanently or use it for enhanced oil recovery or other things. We have a lot of complementarity there, but still cooperation is quite limited for a variety of reasons. I focus on that for a very simple reason. My sense, and Minister Zhang may have a thought about this, but my sense is no matter how much China does in the coming decade on investments in wind, more hydro, more nuclear, importing more natural gas, and so forth, coal consumption is still going to grow dramatically. Mm-hmm. And China in recent years, I believe, has added each year the amount of coal it uses for power generation has increased by 200 million tons per year. It's just absolutely startling. It's breathtaking. And that reflects the growth of the Chinese economy and the structure of the Chinese economy and the relative availability of different sources of energy. So if we can't get to some way to mitigate the climate impact mm-hmm. of that kind of enormous mm-hmm. consumption and growing consumption of coal, we're in deep, deep trouble. Right. And so this, to my mind, is one of the areas right. where U.S.-China cooperation may move ahead quite a bit.
Can I just quickly amplify one
please,
point on
please,
that?
Please,
sir. I think it directly relates. Apart from what the United States and China, and I agree wholeheartedly with what Dr. Lieberthal just said, but we shouldn't forget the rest of the world. Mm. A lot of people, particularly those concerned about climate change and the environmental community in this country, which takes great pride in that we've reduced the use of coal, at least in power generation, fails to note that the rest of the world, coal is growing apace. In fact, a study my program released last May on LNG pointed out that we think after 2020, one of the greatest competitors to world LNG, and particularly LNG from the United States, is going to be coal. Because the reality, there are huge coal mines under development around the world today as we speak in places like Kazakhstan. People don't realize the coal resources of Kazakhstan and BTU equivalent dwarf those of oil and gas. You've got coal coming out of Mozambique, Indonesia, a whole slew of places. These are world-class coal plants, which means that in the Asian power market particularly, where coal remains extremely competitive, unless there is a global price put on carbon, coal is going to remain extremely competitive against LNG, against pipeline gas, against oil, and in many cases against renewables for far into the future.
That's a very relevant point. I don't like hearing myself echo in my ear here. There was another implication I thought I might draw you out on, Charlie, before, and you raised it a bit about the trade-offs between food stamps and aircraft carriers, which is kind of an unusual characterization. But it would seem to me that the logic of what you lay out is that America's traditional role in sea lane security will persist in one form or another, but the imperative of that may look somewhat different, whereas for China, this becomes a much more of an operative consideration. Now, you know, frankly, this is not something necessarily that ought to cause great fixation, except maybe in some quarters of our defense establishment, but it's not intrinsically the case that, for example, if you argue that China plays a larger role here, that this is at cross purposes to the United States, quite the contrary. But it does seem to me inexorable as you look at China both having a growing array of maritime interests, even in a global context, that its efforts in these areas will increase, even as you also point out, that because of developments in Central Asia and the like, it's not as if China makes a choice. China does both. I think that's a very, very important strategic implication to keep in mind. I'd like to open it up to the audience. I'm sure there are lots of questions here. I see a hand right here from Mr. CNN.
Wrong network, PBS.
Oh, PBS. I'm sorry. Humiliated.
Quite humiliated. Different.
Very different.
But following up on your question, the implications of what Dr. Lieberthal said, and this is really for Minister Zhang, in addition to a military buildup, and there are a lot of people in the United States that are already nervous about what China is doing in that area already, if you're going to get involved securing the Middle East, the history of both the British and the Americans is that that runs directly counter to a fundamental Chinese principle of non-interference in internal affairs. The history of the Brits and the Americans in the Middle East is very heavy involvement in the internal affairs of Middle Eastern countries. So can China take this expanded role in securing its Middle East oil supplies without violating this basic principle of Chinese foreign policy?
You have to speak for the 1.4 yes, billion people. Chinese people.
I will comment on your answer.
我觉得,
I think, as we mentioned earlier, China also has imported a lot more than 10 years ago. But I would also like to give you another number. The dependency of China on foreign energy is still quite low if we compare ourselves to the United States. I said that the energy independence of the United States has gone up to 81%. China only relies on foreign energy is only 10%. You think I'm making up this story, but go back and look at the data and you can tell that I'm telling the truth. You know why? Because we only import crude oil. And then now, in recent years, we also import about 40 billion tons of natural gas, only lately. But coal is still our primary fuel that can be produced within China. And so we did import 5 million tons compared to the 60 billion tons that we already produced. That's nothing. So maybe people want to sell to China hoping, not that we need it, but then you can get good prices here. So I think our coal accounts for 69% of our primary energy consumption. So power generation relies on 83% relies on coal. Now it's 78%. And I would like to give you another number. I think most of you do not know this number. Last year, the power generated from renewable energy has already accounted for 23%. What renewable energy means: water, solar, and also wind energy. Now, solar is very limited, but water, hydro, and then also wind, which is now the third largest energy source for us. I think a lot of people don't know that. Now, wind energy is our third source of energy in China. But I know the experts know, but most people do not know. Last year, you know how much power? 10 over 10 billion kilowatts. Yeah, 104 billion, right? Kilowatts hours. That is from wind energy alone. So which is, there's more power generated from wind energy than from nuclear energy. So we also have hydro energy, and then we also have some biomass energy. So, and this renewable energy has already accounted for 23% of power generation in China. A few years ago, when I came to California beaches, I saw a lot of windmills. That was something that we never saw in China before. But now we see that installed capacity is now has exceeded 63 million kilowatt hours. So I think that this kind of development is going to pick up speed. And the big difference between this and the United States is that nuclear energy accounts for 15% of the power generation for China. It's only 2%. So if we can raise the 2% to 8%, then we're going to depend less from on foreign energy. So what I want to say is that we don't really need to send our naval fleets to protect our sea lanes. I think that's still a long, long way ago. Why don't the Americans do the job for now?
And I think Minister Zhang gave a very accurate portrayal of the electricity sector in China, power generation sector. But when you look to the Middle East in China, you're talking about transportation and petrochemicals, things other than power generation. Mm-hmm. And there, the dependence is growing very rapidly. Mm-hmm. And you see that reflected in China's own activities in the Middle East. I have had fun in the last 6 months or so, when I've talked with Chinese colleagues in Beijing and elsewhere, teaching them a new term that even the best English speakers trained in China tend not to know. I'm sure Americans will know what I'm talking about. It's the term tar baby. Mm-hmm. Right? In the Middle East, it's a tar baby. Mm-hmm. Right? We have found that everyone who has participated in the Middle East has found the Middle East to be a tar baby. I see everyone of Chinese background here sitting here saying, what is he talking about? Right? So I'll describe very briefly a tar baby. You know, tar is, you know, blacktop on the streets. If it's warm, it gets a little softer and stickier. Tar baby is this story about it looks like a snowman, but it's made out of tar.
我们中国叫沥青，沥青，中国叫沥青，就是那个意思嘛。
Oh, well, then I don't have to explain. But fundamentally, you get involved in the Middle East, you always think you can get involved and make an impact and then pull out. And you find you can't pull out. You simply get more involved. And you have even more trouble pulling out. And China is now sufficiently engaged, whether it's in Iran or Saudi Arabia and in other parts of the Middle East, that it cannot sit back and simply articulate principles of non-interference in internal affairs. It's getting drawn into internal affairs. And it has kicked the tar baby. And so that's why I say that the U.S. and China and others need to cooperate a lot more than we have in order to maximize the chances of outcomes in the Middle East that we can all live with.
Right. Thank you, Ken.
Let me give you another number. Because we talk about the dependency of the United States on Middle East is going up instead of coming down, even though overall dependency on foreign energy is going down. But your dependency on the Middle East is still up. So here's the data. In 2001, the U.S. imported about over 2 million barrels a day from the Middle East. That's 2001, which accounts for 22.8% of your imported oil from the world. But this number has gone down. By the year 2009, it hits the bottom. You only imported over 1.6 million barrels a day from that region, which only accounts for 13.99% of your overall energy imported. But in 2010, you import more from the Middle East again, almost like 2.7 million barrels a day again. So again, it accounts for 20% of your imported energy from the Middle East, from the world. But you import less from Africa and South America. So when someone asks a question, I think you, the Americans, should continue to protect the sealants. Otherwise, you are not going to make up for that 20%.
Let's turn to more questions. There's a question right there. Can you wait for the microphone?
Thank you. Thank you very much for your remarks. It's very enlightening. And the next question that
And I'm sorry, your identification was
Michael Colopy, ICCI.
Yeah, okay.
Given the changing, really tectonic shifts in balance of energy usage in the economies you've described, how will these changes perhaps mitigate the tensions for resources in the competition for resources in the South China Sea, such as in the Palawan Straits and elsewhere?
Is that directed at anyone in particular?
I'll make an initial comment about it. One, I think while the level of tension may have been informed in part by visions of undersea resources in contested areas, there is also a strong component of simple nationalism involved here. We're talking about sovereignty over maritime jurisdictions, and sovereignty issues are never easy to resolve. In terms of what the undersea resources are, there was actually a recent study done by a United States entity, I've forgotten which one right now, that concluded that, in fact, there are very few recoverable reserves of energy in these contested areas in the South China Sea. I think the reality is, because they're contested, they've never been fully explored, and so no one really knows, so different people have their own images.
Yeah.
But I would not count on... I think the image of those resources has perhaps fed some of the fervor over this, but the fervor having been ignited, I don't think it will disappear as resource estimates change, because I think that there's a strong nationalist and emotional dimension to this now that will not easily be set aside.
Very good. Yes. Other questions? Yes, the gentleman there with this waving his hand.
Thank you. Dong Huiyu with China Review News Agency of Hong Kong. And when Secretary Kerry made his visit to Tokyo, he made a speech in Tokyo University, and he put a lot of attention to the energy issue and the climate change, and he said that the energy policy could be part of the climate change solution, and he also mentioned that China 10 years ago just invested $1 million in United States energy sector, but last year increased to $9 billion. So he seems to be attaching more importance on U.S.-China energy cooperation. But I'm wondering, what is the major obstacle between the two countries need to be overcome. What practical recommendation would you like to make to Obama administration and Xi administration? Thank you. For both Mr. Lieberthal and Mr. Zhang. Thank you.
Let me take on this first. I don't think I can hide away from this question. Actually, I already said this earlier. China and U.S. are the two largest energy producing and consuming countries, but we invested very little in the energy sector. This morning, I gave a number. Last year, among the foreign investments, only 0.5 went to China, so which is a very small amount of the overall foreign investment. Someone mentioned 3%, which is still very small, but I think it's 0.5. So the two countries should have a lot of space for further investment and cooperation. As you said, a lot of private companies recently had made investments, but they were not taken note by the media, and you know that. These companies did their work and the investment very quietly. They had already invested in solar energy, in wind energy, and other types of energy. But because it's a small amount and they've done so quietly, and so nobody paying any attention. Actually, we can put in more investment in the sector. For example, CNOOC acquired Nexen, N-E-X-E-N, for $15 billion U.S. dollars, and most of the Nexen's assets were in the United States, and the United States approved it. And that's why there's a deal striking between China and Canada. And in the past, when CNOOC tried to acquire Unocal, we did not have the same results. So if both sides understand each other better and do not allow the ideologies to affect our cooperation, then I believe that our two countries have a lot to do in the future together.
Maybe 2 points to it, because I think the potential for U.S.-China energy cooperation is enormous. And that potential has only begun to be acted on. If you look at what's constrained it in the past, a couple of the problems on the American side have been very sharp restrictions that China applies to foreign direct participation in energy exploitation in China. I mean, it's just not a very open sector. And secondly, major concerns about protection of intellectual property rights in technology, and we've had issues there in the wind sector, in solar, in almost across the board. So I think those things can be addressed and are being addressed, but those have been, constraining elements to this point. I think one of the big stories that should have come out of the Kerry visit to Asia, remember he spent 24 hours in China, basically a day in South Korea, a day in Japan. The China visit, the American reporting on it, was 99.9% North Korea. But in fact, if you look at it, the U.S. and China issued a joint statement during the Kerry visit on cooperation on climate change. And it was a statement that 2 years ago no one could have imagined. This was forward-looking. It was detailed. It was scientifically sound. We are now establishing a working group to build toward the strategic and economic dialogue that raises the climate change issue to ministerial-level consideration and an ongoing process. This is a different world out there now. And it shows, in part, the way the media works, that no one bothered to mention it. But it may be one of the more important long-term things that came out of this visit.
Well,
let me add to that. In the energy sector, if we cooperate, two countries will enjoy win. If we have conflicts in the energy sector, then we're going to lose both ways.
Take solar energy, for example. Some American businesses said that they actually want to investigate the export of solar energy products by Chinese companies. There is a group of other American businesses who actually are opposed to raising tariffs on the Chinese exports. Of course, the whole incident ended with the rise of tariffs by the United States. There's another issue. I'm not sure whether the media has paid enough attention. In terms of the materials, like the multi-silicon, I mean, that actually China imported 40 tons of it from the United, from three vendors. One is from the American company, one is a German company, the third vendor is from a company from South Korea. So only a little bit from Dow Corning, an American business that exports 20 tons of multi-silicon to United States, to China. But because of the investigation, the solar industry in China actually talk about whether there is this dumping of the multi-silicon by American business. And the Chinese government hasn't started yet. And once the investigation starts, and the, there will be a stop of imports. So so the Dow Corning actually, the CEO visited China, and he complained to me that the export to China has come down to almost zero. So wouldn't that be loss to the United States? I believe the ultimate loss actually is suffered by the clean energy industry if we have a trade war.
Now, we only have time for one or two more questions, so the woman right here, please. And I apologize that we'll have to avoid giving everyone a chance to ask questions, but we're on a very tight schedule. But please.
My name is Mary Birdman from Executive Intelligence Review. Dr. Liebenthal brought up the question of water, and this is, in my understanding, an enormously important issue in China. Professor Biswas, recently of one of the leading, world-leading international water institutes, said China may have two decades to solve this question. And what I wanted to raise is the issue of the development of energy in China. Not only does gas extraction use, and coal, of course, use enormous amounts of water, but the amount of energy that would have to be allocated to something like desalinization projects and so forth, to what degree is this being factored in? Because I've done some research on the North-South Water Project. I mean, the amount of pollution, cleaning up the polluted water, these are all energy-intensive but absolutely vital projects for China's future, and just like how, to what degree is this being factored into China's energy projections?
Mr. Zhang, I think that would be
The question you raised is actually a key issue faced by China. This is a serious problem faced by China because China actually lack water resources in a lot of regions, especially in the western region, where there has always been a shortage of water. And there are also some coastal areas. And shale gas is an excellent idea. Well, of course, the extraction of it will consume a lot of water. You need to have high-pressure water, actually, to put the water into the deeper, into the ground, would actually increase pollution, would actually cause earthquake and everything. It is a controversial issue. However, you know, we do not have, like, per capita water resource compared with the United States. When you do the shale gas, and China actually will have to solve the issue of water because that would be the key issue to whether China can actually tap shale gas. The forum actually was visited by a lot of American companies. The representatives had a roundtable discussion. And I give a talk at the table. I said, maybe I'm not an expert. If I make a proposal, don't laugh at me. Like Dr. Litherman who talk about CCS, so the carbon sequestration. And so if you actually put the carbon dioxide that deep into the ground, can you actually make it into water? So after I put forward the proposal, you know, some experts, both from China and United States, thought it's not like I'm telling a story of Arabian Nights. And Mr. Sandra said that, you know, Minister Zhang raised the issue that needs further exploration. There's another CEO from a Chinese company also agreed with me because you make so much efforts to sequestrate and actually, you know, all the carbon dioxide deep into the ground. Why don't you convert it into like water? You need over 10, you know, the pressures, 10 units of pressure to do it. And you make it into water, you need a 33.
Okay, go ahead.
China obviously has an acute water problem. But one of the biggest problems that may loom in the future is the amount of energy China needs to use to move water from where it isn't to where it needs to be. But the other problem I think China has to be very sensitive to is that in the course of solving its own water problems, it doesn't create more problems for its neighbors. Because the diversion of waters from the Tibetan Plateau is desperately threatening the subcontinent's water supply. And you can make projections that in 20 years, the whole subcontinent has a dire water crisis. And likewise, when we see some of the problems that have arisen with some of the plans to construct dams on Myanmar's territory adjoining China, and the problems that has created with ethnic strife inside Myanmar, just saying as part of your overall water solution, you may engage in a little bit of water diplomacy as well.
One last comment from Ken, and then we'll have to, unfortunately...
Highlight the ongoing theme of climate change in this. Climate change is dramatically worsening China's water problems. Right. It's worsening it in three ways. One, it is melting the glaciers on the High Tibetan Plateau, which is the water tower of Asia for parts of South Asia, for most of Southeast Asia, and for all of China. So as those glaciers melt, this vast system is being thrown into a future of great uncertainty. Secondly, sea levels are rising. Shanghai is at sea level. Other major Chinese economic centers are at sea level or very near it. And thirdly, North China is drying out. You put that combination together and you've got yourself a huge crisis that continues to build in future years. It's probably the biggest single crisis that China faces going forward.
A sobering set of comments. I must say, Ken, your use of the term sequestration today reminds us that maybe it has a good context as well if we can do something about it. So,
well, our sequestration problem is minor by comparison.
Indeed. Please give all of our panelists a round of applause. An excellent panel. We have to change quickly and then bring a new set of panelists on the stage.
Hi. Good to see you again. If I could encourage the next set of panelists to come up on the stage, I'm sorry to do a...
Do we really? If we're going to get out of here by 4.
So it fell through the cracks as far as attention being paid to it is concerned. But I think it's really important because we're talking about the reform of the government structure, and it looked at the constitution of China and also the organization law of the State Council to issue this paper. Mr. Xi Jinping and also Premier Li Keqiang, after they came to office and after they participate in an 18th conference, he said that we all need to abide by the constitution of a country. This is something new or refreshing, because in the past, when we have a new government coming to office, no one would remind you that you need to abide by the constitution. This is the first time we've heard of it. And then next, it also talked about we need to execute democratic decision making, and also we need to make government affairs more transparent, more public. Because in the past, a lot of decisions were made after different agencies talked to each other, but now they have to make the decisions and the process of reaching that decision to be open to the public. And then it also says that we need to accept the oversight of the MPC and the Standing Committee, and also of CPPCC and People's Court. And so they need to accept the oversight of these organizations and also abide by and comply with the legal effective judgments of the People's Court. I think this is showing us that the NPC, or the National People's Congress, and the government is legislature, government, we're looking at a kind of check and balance between these three different arms of the government. Now, judging from the 18th Congress and also the second plenary, and according to the working rules set out by the Premier and the State Council, we can see that this is hoping that this will push forward, propel the government-related political restructuring. In other words, you need to work, minister within the framework of the Constitution, and you need to also have to formulate a check and balance system or mechanism among the three different arms of the government. This will also help advance democratic decision making and make government affairs more public. And also, you would delegate more power to NGOs that include like associations and chambers and so on and so forth. So I think the 18th Congress and the second plenary have produced these documents that will push forward a political reform. I guess this would at least give them some ideas as to how to do it. For example, it asks them that they would do all this, administer within the framework of the Constitution, which is, I think, it's very important. during the 18th Congress, we are not looking only at the big picture. We're also looking at the details. For example, in the next plenary, for example, during the third plenary, you can see them fine-tuning this framework that they have set out or laid down for us during the first or second plenary. Also, the emphasis is now placed on transmitting government functions. In other words, you have the separate enterprise public services. And to... he flipped it too quickly. Anyway, so then they also need to supervise more on food safety and also on pollution. Premier Li Keqiang placed emphasis on this, and it's also being incorporated into the working report that we need to cut down on the number of departments and also employees and the budget. So it's kind of a natural in other words, they also want to control the institutions of personnel in terms of budget. Our budget was basically within the range of 17 trillion to close to 18 trillion, about 18 trillion, which accounts for about 35% of our GDP. So, meaning that a lot of things are not accounted for in the budget. Because in the past, we had these documents, we kept issuing, I said, you cannot take this kind of sedan, you cannot eat lavishly, and so on and so forth, but we could not control the officers because we did not actually do something with the budget. And therefore, you can issue a lot of papers and orders telling people not to do this and that, but then if the budget's there, then they can continue to do it. And so now if you control or restrict the budget, then I think it will become more effective. And then we also try to slow down the growth rate of government revenue. Our new Minister of Finance said that, you know, a bigger tax revenue is not necessarily a big thing because in the U.S., because I think in the U.S., if your revenue is too big, bigger than the budget, then it may be termed as illegal. So this time we also have the same tone. We said that, you know, too big a revenue may not necessarily be a good thing. So we also talk about cutting the scale administrative expenses, gradually rationalize it in the budget. Because we have a lot of administrative expenses, so that we need to cut down as well. And also we need to publicize the income expenditure of government and make it under the review of the MPC. What? Someone is reminding me. I have 2 minutes left. And then also we need to adjust and reform the relationship between the central governments and local authorities. We need to enlarge or give more power to local governments and delegate power to the counties. We also need to reduce the interferences of the ministries in local governments in approval. Standard sets and so forth. Because a lot of times we want to hit the target of the kind of orders or instructions that we give, and then so there's a lot of this kind of things. So we're just trying to get results, and so there's a lot of interferences. Now we said that we have to reduce the number of administrative approval from 82 cases to even less. And then also we need to draw a clear line of demarcation between central and local government authorities, public service authorities. In the past, the line was very, very blurred. And then we also set up a stable tax mechanism for local governments. So all these transfer payments are very messy because we don't see very clear lines of demarcations. I'm giving very short time, so this is all I can. I don't have time to elaborate. Thank you.
for giving this description of the reform agenda as just announced in the after the new People's Congress. When we come back, actually, I would like to ask both you and other panelists to think about, given that the title of this panel is Challenges to Implementing Reform, I would ask you to address further what are the challenges to actually to implement these reform agenda. So later on, Professor Zhou, I would ask you and others to actually comment more on how these goals can be achieved. What are the challenges to achieve these reform goals? So now let's move to the second speaker, Professor Cai Fang from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences.
In addition to reform, another word, magic word, you have to think about if you talk about China is population. So I'm going to talk about demographic transition and social issues, also with some implications to the economic growth. First of all, we are facing a turning point. Let's see. If you remember, in the past so many years, the Chinese leaders always wanted to keep at least 8% annual growth rate of GDP. But last year, actually, at least the central government didn't try very hard to maintain 8%. Actually, last year it was only 7.8%. At the same time, the significantly reduced GDP growth rate didn't cause very significant unemployment issue or employment pressure. The urban registered unemployment rate was only 4.1%. Yeah, this is registered unemployment rate. And also the wage rate, particularly for the unskilled workers, continued to increase. And the demand, the job supply and demand ratio remained at high, above 100%. That is, there are more jobs created than more new entrant who wanted a job. So this is a year of significant. So what happened? We shift to the demographic transition. In the past over 30 years, along with the fast economic growth, there has been a tremendous decline of fertility rate. So you can see this. Currently, the total fertility rate in China is about 1.4. It's lower than the average of developed countries, about the same as in Japan. So as a result of the demographic transition, we will have a different structure of population, particularly in terms of age. A few years ago, in China, people debate about whether or not China arrived at a Lewis turning point. That is the point at which the labor shortage appears and the wage rate for unskilled workers increases. So, but if you debate about this phenomena in Japan, say, you have at least 30 years to debate about whether or not the turning point comes until you run out demographic dividend. But in Korea, you can do it within 40 years. But in China, first of all, you know, the labor shortage appears in 2004. And at the beginning, it was a phenomenon in the coastal areas. And afterwards, it widely spread to the nationwide. And, you know, since then, the growth rate of, migrant workers' wages has been at least 13% per year in real term. And then you haven't finished the discussion about the turning point. The working age population, that is the population aged between 15 and 59, stopped increasing in 2010. And last year and the year before last year, the working age population were negative growth. So if we consider the Lewis turning point as a turning period, we finished the period. So we don't need to debate it anymore. And as a result, in the past 30 years, we have benefited from a demographic dividend. That is, all the population factors fueled the fast economic growth in capital accumulation, in supply of labor, supply of human capital, or the total factor productivity improvement. In that case, if we run out the demographic dividend, we will face lower growth. First of all, you know, in the future, labor supply will be negative, given the labor force participation rate. And we suppose total factor productivity will continue the same trend as it was previously. And then the growth rate of investment were relatively slower because in the past it was too fast. Average annual growth rate of investment was something like 16%. But in the future, we assume it's lower as 13%. But I believe if we can reduce it further, that would be more balanced economic growth. With all these assumptions, we can estimate the potential GDP growth rate for the future. So in the 11th five-year plan period, the potential GDP growth rate was 10.5%. It will decline to 7.2% in the current five-year plan period, and a further decline to 6.1% in 13th five-year plan period. That is what we, you know, I think a conservative estimation of the GDP growth, potential GDP growth. So this is how the demographic transition changed the future growth rate of the Chinese economy. And so we didn't see unemployment problem when the growth rate declined, but that means the labor market is tight, but the labor force is still vulnerable, which will result in social issues in the future, in very new future. First of all, let's see who are the vulnerable in the labor market. Remember, I mentioned the urban registered unemployment rate was 4.1% last year. But in the past almost 10 years, it's about 4.1. At the same time, if you estimate the natural unemployment rate, is about the same. That's the pink line. So that means, you know, the unemployment registration is only applied to the urban resident with local hukou. That means the resident, urban resident with local hukou suffered the natural unemployment, but they don't have problem with cyclical unemployment. Who are those people who suffer cyclical unemployment? The migrant workers. Every time when the economy boom, they come to the cities and they find job easily. And when the crisis came, they were forced to go back to their home villages. So they are not necessarily counted as unemployment people, but they lose job when the economic go ups and downs. So this is two different groups. So what are the urban employment, what's the composition of urban labor force? Totally in the urban labor market, about one third is migrant workers who live and work in urban areas, but they don't have a local hukou. Two-thirds are people who have local hukou. In terms of the increment, that is incremental amount in labor market of urban areas in 2011, two-thirds of the new entrant are migrant workers in urban labor market. So they are very significant. And why we need labor from rural areas? Because they have a totally different demographic characteristics. We draw the map, putting the urban hukou resident labor force on the resident, actually, on the left, and the urban non-hukou migrants on the right. You can see they have a significantly different characteristics of population. So that is the new entrant are mainly dependent of migrant workers. So that's the two groups in urban labor market. So for the urban people, because in China we have this phenomenon, that is as the ages go up, the education, the years of schooling go down very dramatically. That is a very picture describing the urban residents. So therefore, if somebody, you know, in China, there are widespread debate about whether or not we should postpone the retirement age as a labor shortage appears. But, you know, when people reach their 40s or 50s, they have a very low education attainment. They are very vulnerable. They couldn't find a job, actually. So this is the problem with the urban hukou labor force. At the same time, you see, this is what the migrant workers look like. Currently, about more than 60% migrant workers are so-called new generation. That is, they were born after 1980. So they are younger than 30 years old. But these people, actually, you know, if you ask them, actually we have done a surveys by asking some questions. One is, where did you live before 16 years old? You see, one third of them actually lived in urban areas. even though you call them 农民工, they are not. And if you ask where did you go to primary school, they, you know, 38% answer by saying, I went to primary school in urban areas. So that's the totally new profile of migrant workers. And these workers, because the labor market is tight, therefore there is a convergence in wage rate between the skilled and the unskilled workers. That is, unskilled workers tend to earn more money. They have seen faster growth in their wage rate. Therefore, there are some negative incentive for migrant workers to stay at school. They quickly move to the labor market after graduation from junior high school, and even they drop out during the junior high school. But in the future, the industrial structure change will put them in a further vulnerable position. You see, the current average years of schooling for migrant workers is 9.6 years. They are quite good, suitable to the labor-intensive secondary sector that requires 9 years schooling, and quite good for the labor-intensive tertiary sector that requires exactly 9.6 years education. But if in the future the capital-intensive secondary or technology-intensive tertiary sectors expand, they will not fit for these new jobs. So if in the past, in the late 1990, we have had a problem with 4050, sorry, that is the older workers who have much lower education, we will see the same situation at a much younger ages. So what, and also they migrant workers, only because they don't have a local hukou, they are poorly covered by the social insurance programs. You see the five major programs. And this is an indication how they tend to involved in labor disputes. That's, 2008 is something like a legislation effect, but the general trend is increase of labor disputes. So I think I will have time to discuss about the reform, so I stop here. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Caifang. Our last panelist for this whole day, and also, of course, for this panel, is Professor Wang Jisi, and he'll have the floor to address whatever reform issues he chooses to do. But afterwards, we're going to have all three panelists up on the floor, on the stage, and then we can further to discuss reform issues.
Thank you very much. I'm the last speaker, but I don't want to take too much time because I would like to leave enough time for general discussion. But I don't know what reform is. So the topic of this panel is to how to implement reform. And I'm a scholar and I'm an administrator at a school. So I'm thinking about what reform measures I'm faced with. I don't see reform. I see a lot of changes. Wang Feng just raised the question of what is reform. So I start from here. That is, what is reform? And I'm studying international politics. And I link China's reform to international issues. This is what I can do. That is from the, you know, we talk reform and opening. When China first introduced reform measures, it was the late 1970s, early 1990s. And the world at that time was very different from what we see today. There's this Mrs. Thatcher in Britain, President Reagan in the United States. The world was turning to the right. If the right description is the right. I mean, the United States is the right nation, we say. And at that time, the reform was aimed at that direction. We saw the direction there, if I'm not politically incorrect. That is, the world is moving into that direction, and China in the past was into a different direction. So China needed reform at that time. So the first target was the four dragons, little dragons, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore. And then the next target at that time, to some economists, leading economists I know in China, they said that the next target would be Japan. And the ultimate destination would be the United States. But today we, you know, the four little dragons are far behind in terms of the size of the of their economy, and even the efficiency is not very impressive. And then Japan, we bypassed Japan. And the next target, the United States, but the United States is not in very good shape. So what is the target? What is the destination of reform? And that is the question, and as an intellectual, I pose the question to you. And the world we see today is in China, this is debatable, because some people say this is still the world we saw 30 years ago. That is, this is not dominated by Western countries. And we see this international economic and order somewhat intact, even after the financial crisis, even after September 11th, and the United States is still the leading power. So this is one view, but people don't say that very directly. Another view we can hear very frequently in China today, that is, the world is changing so rapidly. And the United States is no longer the leading power, or it is declining. And other countries are rising up. The BRICS and the other developing countries or new emerging countries, newly emerging countries are rising up. So we don't accept this existing international order as we said we would in the past. You know, although at that time, we didn't say we accept the international order, but we said, no, we could do some reform. So this is a larger background of reform. But this reform is different from the reform 10 years ago or 20 years ago we were talking about at that time. That is my understanding of reform. Listening to Professor Zhou Tianyong very carefully, I sense some direction there, that is more transparent government, less role of the government in society and the economy. But I do not know whether I'm entirely correct in saying so, because in my real life, for instance, I'm an educator, I see a stronger role of the government in my academic work, in the sources of income, in the sources of financial support, you know, schools and so on. So this is another challenge. To put myself into another topic, that is whether we should do some reform in China's diplomacy. I had some contacts with China's diplomats. They say, well, diplomacy is not exactly foreign relations. because diplomacy is between government and government. We are very strong in diplomacy. Our diplomats are very able, and they speak different languages and so on. But the foreign relations are not in very good shape, according to some diplomats. So we have to improve our decision-making processes. Many people know that. That is how to better coordinate among different government agencies, the military, the foreign affairs bureaus, big enterprises, ocean administration, and intelligence organizations. A lot of organizations, government agents are involved in foreign policy. So we need to do some reform or whatever changes to improve the coordination. And this is not the reform we are really talking about. That is the reduce of the role of the government. Actually, we are going to strengthen the role of the government in that regard. Another slogan, another concept is public diplomacy. And still, I don't know very much about public diplomacy because we talk very much, but I don't know whether this is between the Chinese government and foreign governments or foreign, including NGOs, and or whether it is also more about Chinese governments or foreign affairs agencies with the people, not only abroad, but people in China. If that latter is true, then we should listen more to the Chinese people who are asking for a more assertive Chinese foreign policy rather than a more moderate one. And so this is a state-society relationship. And China still is, in my analogy of state-society relations, this is not a political science understanding, but in my study of U.S.-China relations, China is a state. The United States is a society, and we are not very able to deal with society as large as this. And this applies to the whole world. Now China is faced with immense challenges around the world, not only from governments, foreign governments, African, Latin American, but more from the global society. And that goes to soft power. And we talk a lot about soft power. But soft power is, does soft power generate, is soft power generated from the state, from the government, or it is more related to society? And that is a big challenge. And so I'm putting forward some questions rather than the answers. And listening to the previous speakers today, I'm really puzzled. The first, the conclusion of my listening to the first panel is China's overseas investment is expanding. And the second panel, the impression I had was Chinese banks are profitable. And the third panel, I didn't listen to the full, but I think Mr. Zhang Guobao was very eloquently telling us that we don't have too much problem with that. You have a lot of problem. If you correct your mistakes or your misunderstandings of China, then we are in a better position. Although I know he is a very strongly promoting reform in China, but I think the question is also yours. So finally, still I have the question about the destination or the purpose of reform rather than specific answers. Because I'm an intellectual, I'm not very practical, but so sorry for the very intellectual and very abstract questions to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Wang Jisi, for raising those hard questions. I think we'll try to answer some of those in the remaining time we have. Now, may I invite you to come up to the stage? And I think we need to be connected with right, Mike. Okay. All right. So we have about the last half hour to both, I think, to discuss the subject of this particular panel and for the whole day, I suppose. Now, each of the panelists has had time to address the specific topics they choose to do. I still have a number of questions, but I would not give you time to make speeches again. But instead, I'll raise these questions and I'll ask audience to raise questions, and hopefully some of the questions would be the same, and then you can address these. I think as we, as Professor Wang Ji just raised, the question is, when we talk about reforms now, what do they mean? And where are we going? What are the purposes of reforms, right? Clearly, this has been the term that's been used to cover everything under the sun in China for the last 30 years and more. And then the content of the reform actually has been an evolving project. So what are we talking about at this particular time point? That's number one question. I think later on we'd like to have more focus. The second question I would raise is, what do you think are the most important reforms in your mind? And then third one is, in what order those reforms should be carried out? And then the last one is, what challenges or the difficulties in implementing one or more of the reforms that are high on your agenda? So we heard about government reforms from Professor Zhou Tianyong, and Professor Cai Fang's talk certainly mentioned household registration system, urban rural urban migration, and Professor Wang Jisi's remarks involved state and society and China and the world. So clearly these are some of the themes you want to address. But I would not give you time right now to do so, because otherwise we won't have time to entertain questions. So I'll open the floor and, okay. So yeah, over there.
Bill Jones, EIR. Professor Tsai, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the much-discussed hukou reform. There's been a lot of demands about this. This has been debated back and forth. I was wondering, what effect would it have on the employment situation, either positively or negatively, if there were a serious reform of the hukou? And in terms of the employment situation and the unemployment situation, how is this reflected regionally? Of course, there's been an attempt now for development in the Western countries. There's been a lot of activity, industrial activity, that's been located more centrally rather than on the coasts. How has that developed over the last few years, and how is it reflected in unemployment regionally, coast versus the central areas?
I think, first of all, I want to combine your question with Wang Feng's. Number one reform for me is hukou reform, because I talked about the potential GDP decline in the future, but we should think, should we see the declining GDP growth. We shouldn't. We don't do something like stimulation or industrial policies to stimulate demand side things, but actually we can increase the potential growth rate from supply side. Actually, we simulated one effect, that is if you increase labor force participation rate by 1 percentage point every year between 2011 and 2020, you will have almost 1 percentage point GDP growth during the period. Another simulation is if you increase 1 percentage point total factor productivity during this period, you gain the same percentage point of potential GDP growth rate. So if we have the Hooker reform, first of all, we will have a larger supply of labor force because, you know, the total working age population declines. So if you want to increase labor supply, the only way you can do is to increase the labor force participation rate. But without the hukou, the migrant workers can, you know, they expect to go back to their home villages. Therefore, in most cases, they retired, they quit from the urban labor market at about 40 years old. So you lost 20 years of labor supply. And also, if you continue to support the labor mobility from low productivity agriculture sector to higher productivity sector in urban areas, you continue to gain the reallocative efficiency. That is a total factor productivity gain. So that's a very important reform. Some sentence about the regional pattern change. I think in the past, let's say 10 years, we have seen three kind of rebalancing among regions. First of all, the central government implemented the going west strategy, that is allocating more infrastructure constructions with government-led investment in the central and the western regions. So that's we can see a very significant effect, actually. Secondly, because in western areas, the western areas are resource abundant areas. Therefore, a lot of state-owned enterprises invest heavily in those areas that generate GDP growth. But basically, those projects are not labor intensive. They didn't absorb much employment. But in very recent years, you can see there are so-called flying geese effect. That is, the labor-intensive manufacturing tends to shift from coastal to inland areas. That's actually very good for absorbing the local migrant workers. Currently, actually, the older migrant workers who used to work in the coastal areas now being employed locally, maybe at the same company. So that's what my observation is.
Okay. This gentleman over here.
Hi, my name is Richard Shin. I'm with The Economist Incorporated. I'm an economist by training. You talked about maybe purpose for reform. I mean, obviously, depending on the country's state status, you could have different types of reform. I mean, do you want to maintain power like North Korea is doing? You know, try to coexist fight for your existence, or are you trying to make your population be happy by having growth, stable growth in the economy? Do you want to project your power in the world? I mean, there are a lot of different types of issues that are involved, and the different reforms would match the goals that you would have for your government and your people. So, you know, I think you put a very nice touch by saying, you know, what are the reforms that's needed and what's the order that's needed in China? And I let the experts answer that. My question really comes down to rule of law and predictability. So, for example, if China wants to develop and have foreigners come in and invest, and this is true also for Chinese companies, you know, the foreigners have to have an environment in which there is a predictability in their business. That is, you know, what is the regulation? Is the regulation ad hoc, or is it there's a rule of reason there that you know that if you do certain actions that you will thrive in your business? And if some, you know, dispute occurs, is there a very reasonable rule of law that's in existence that will allow adjudication of those disputes? And I was wondering, you know, what is the state of that type of situation in China, and whether or not there is a reform needed in that part?
Okay. Well, actually, there are two sets of kind of two sides of this question about rule of law. One is the ones, the examples you try to allude to, meaning the with foreign companies, with foreigners. The other is really with the rights of the people within within China. I think both are quite important. I don't know who would like to address this. Professor Zhou Tianyu, would you want to talk about rule of law?
I think that the purpose of reform comes in many shapes and forms. I think there are three major ones. First, you want to keep the economic vibrancy to be sustainable, like what Premier Li said, that you need to gain some reform dividends. And then also, you need to take care of the life or of the people, that they will have equality, they will be happy. But if you look at it from a as a system, then I think the ultimate goal would be to build a modern country ruled by law and also with democracy. I think if you want to talk about reform, I think these three aspects are quite important to make that reform happen. I think that there are all kinds of proposals for reform in China. For example, when you talk about fiscal system or the financial system, actually in the year 2005, some ministries or departments have already proposed ways to reform. And then political reform, we also talk about in 2007. But I think maybe because of all kind of objective reasons, we have, even though we have had the proposals, we are still looking at how to implement. We're not talking about how we should reform. I feel that with this new administration coming to office, and I really study their speeches and their presentations, and I've noticed that, for example, Xi Jinping, he proposed, he proposed about China Dream. So everyone's saying, what do you mean by China Dream? What is China Dream? And I couldn't sleep for the last 2 days because I was trying to think, what is China Dream? Someone said, well, why? I said, I kept making dreams. Those, they said, well, now that you're in America, aren't you having the American dream now? I said, no, it's still a China dream. So what I'm trying to say here is that the China dream, or the Chinese dream of President Xi, has been quite cleverly elaborated by him. In the past, when we talk about Chinese dream, we talk about China being strong, But during these two important conferences, he defined the Chinese dream as to give opportunity to every individual in China that if you work hard, you will get there. I think if you're looking at, I think he's trying to marry the two different definitions of the Chinese dream, because when you talk about individualism, you are looking at more like opportunities being provided by the state to the individuals. For example, when you apply for business licenses and all that, all of these procedures have to be reformed. Otherwise, you will not be able to give what people want, even if you talk about the China dream, Chinese dream. So, as I listen to him, I feel that he is kind of drafting a path for us to take as far as reform is concerned. And Premier Li, also in his speeches and remarks, also talk about to allow China to become more market-oriented and to reduce approvals for all the businesses, and also to reform the business licensing or registration system. So I think he meant to give access to people first.
I believe that it means the society has to provide opportunities for all people. As long as you make efforts, there's a chance of success. And the state has to have the framework in place to ensure that people can do that. This is one point. The other point is that the country actually has to have a modernized system. So basically, I'm not sure whether the leaders actually they want to run the country where people don't have enough to eat. That cannot be possible. However, because of the limitations for a lot of reasons, maybe a lack of experience or a lack of knowledge about modernized concepts. For example, take Deng Xiaoping and Mao Zedong, for example. There was a great difference between the two of them. So in the party, Secretary General Xi and also Premier Li, both of them expressed the will that they want the country to be modernized, at least to move toward that direction. However, during the process, there are difficulties and challenges. There would be interest groups that would probably try to stop or deviate the reforms. So that's why reform is a difficult task.
Listen to the person who asked the question. He used the wording rule of law. But in China, we don't have very much the distinction at this moment between the rule of law and rule by law. And what Professor Zhou Tianyong said in his presentation, I think he emphasized the rule by law. The government should rule the country by law, and the government should abide by the constitution and the laws, and there should be some kind of balance of power between the government, the judiciary part, and then the People's Congress. But then the question I ask is, where is the Communist Party in this? So the Communist Party is above all the three, right? So we go to the very basic question of what is Xiandai Guojia, and Professor Zhu had just mentioned we should establish a modern country, modern state. And to me, a modern state is a state of rule of law rather than rule by law. But this has a long way to go because I think maybe we should have the first stage of rule by law. You have your own laws, and then you act according to the laws you yourself created. And then finally, we'll have to that stage. That is my destination of reform. But this is not a very, very distinctive destination yet.
Thank you. Professor Caifang, do you want to add? Okay, let's ask, let me take a question from this side, this gentleman in the middle.
Hi, thank you. Fascinating discussion. My name is Matthew Robertson. I write for the Epoch Times. My question is exactly on this question of the role of the Communist Party. Do you think that in terms of reform and the challenges to reform, is it a challenge, an impediment, or is it something that's helping China reform? And then, secondly, does the reform that China needs, does it require a modification of the leading role of the Communist Party, or any modification at all? If so, of what kind?
Okay, who would like to take on this question? Professor Zhou, you are with the party school, Central Party School.
我觉得，I think that if we talk about the reform in China, which started in 1978, it was initiated by the Communist Party itself. And the changes that we have seen in the past three decades are huge. So if we talk about the system in China, political system in China, that's significantly different from what it was 30 years ago. And that the change of that actually helped boost the economic growth. Research some statistics. The per capita GDP in 1978 for China is 155, and right now is a lot more. So, and there have been a lot of changes structurally. However, people tend to look at the problems. They tend to say, "Oh, the problems are related to the system." Maybe they're right. So maybe the next three decades, and probably will have a. Even more difficult task in terms of carrying out reform. My personal belief is that the reform will still have to be initiated and led by the Communist Party because there is no other force available. The Communist Party has over 80 million members. I'm not talking about that every party member all holds the same views or has the same view toward reform. I mean, each member, he talks about the interests of the country, the interests of the party, and also their own interests. So they tend to have different views, which I think is normal. That's my second point. The third one is that maybe the next stage of reform, like Premier Li Keqiang said, that it would be like a courageous warrior who has the courage to cut his own hand off. I actually sensed in the government report by Premier Wen Jiabao, it was a political transition, but he did say that there has to be further reform, including a reform of political system. So I believe that I don't think the Chinese Communist Party would be an obstacle, would be like impeding the reform itself. I don't think there is much possibility in that. On the other hand, there are interest groups. Or, for example, if you want to implement like a property taxes, well, those who have more properties will be opposed to it. And whether maybe a lot of them are party members. So another one is that if you want to carry out reform, you want to reform the state-owned enterprises, especially the big ones, probably they have different views. Because the CEOs or the higher executives of the state-owned enterprises are party members, or they're appointed by the party. So it's complicated. So, but what I'm thinking is that, we have had some plans for reform, and all the plans are talking about reform as led by the Communist Party. A lot of people criticize us. They talk about us like a constitution under the party. But I still hold the same view that, you know, we need to have constitution also have the party leadership. Because in China, if you want to have another, you know, a political group significant enough to promote reform, probably, you know, it's hard to say. However, the Communist Party has to view the situation in the right way, how to lead the country on a path towards a modern country with modern system. So for each transition of leadership, I can see progress in each transition.
Another question on this. Yeah, here.
Thank you. Michael Colopy, ICCI. In the transition, we heard very clear statements from the outgoing party secretary, Hu Jintao, former president, and from the premier, Wen Jiabao, as you referred. But we also heard a very clear statement from Xi Jinping as in his capacity as party secretary that if the party did not reform itself, it would be fatal to its own future. These are very dramatic and clear pronunciations which were said before the international press and not just in private settings. Many of us who've worked in China, around China for a long time, know that the party is the ultimate power. But what the party says about the constitution in Harbin is not the same in Chengdu or Wuhan. So therefore, my question is, if there is to be reform, at what point does Guangxi give way to merit, and at what point does quality supersede payoff?
Okay, so could we ask Professor Zhou to address this again, or others?
Guanxi. So talk about Guanxi or connections. You know, we have had a lot of reforms by like issuing new documents and giving out speeches and, or initiate a campaign or something. However, this time I think the base is to respect the constitution so as to perfect the current system. For example, I think that one of the rules of the city council is that by the end of June next year, as everything takes time, however, by the end of June next year, you have to register all the real estate you hold. That applies to everyone. I believe this is a systematic progress. We always talk about transparency or exposure of your personal wealth, but if you don't register, if you don't put it on the internet, how do you say? So now I don't talk about the making your own property public. However, I want you to register. Then everything will be connected through through internet. So that is, in effect, exposure of your personal wealth. So people say that there's a 1 year to go before June next year. So probably we should sell the property we're holding. However, the Chinese government is actually trying to promote the progress in terms of the system. So, for example, if everybody registers his or her property, then you have to pay property tax on it. So what's the point of having too many properties? So you rely on systems. Like the public expenditures on cars and banquets and everything, you know, people have been complaining, the general public has been complaining about it all the time. So is to solve things like this, it's not just, you cannot solve the problem by, you know, some problem by a document issued by the, you know, disciplinary committee saying that, okay, did you eat your cucumber? Did you see some other seafood? You know, because there's no budget for seafood. If you want to eat the fresh seafood, you pay for yourself. And So once you have a better system of the budget, then it's better to carry out the oversight on the public expenses. And one of the hottest debate is on whether budget should be actually made transparent to the general public. I think that Premier Li Keqiang said, well, it has to be made public. So that's one obstacle less for a new legislation, so that there will be a faster pace in the reform. Once you have like opened a budget, then you would know that the personnel or the use of government cars or using government money for like for meals or for other things, then you have to solve the problem at the root. For me, the key is that the party has to set a rule for itself, or a set of rules for itself. I believe that if we look at the rules of work by the city council, that is like setting some rules for itself. If you don't have rules that you also abide by, what's the point of issuing just documents to ask other people to do this and do that? So I believe we have some progress.
Political economy framework. That is, if the party of in power is, the legitimacy of the party in power heavily stakes at, reform. Because the central party now well recognize the major issues. The corruption, guanxi, or misallocation of resources are all from unlimited power of allocating resources by the government. So therefore, as Professor Zhou Tianyu explained, there are a lot of new reforms announced about reducing the power of the government. In that respect, and also because if in the past the government have been supported by the people because the fast economic growth and the improvement of living standard, but in the future, if the previous sources stimulating the economic growth will no longer exist. Therefore, you have to gain new sources to support economic growth. Premier Li Keqiang recognized that one is the reform dividend. So we apart from debating about whether or not the power is legitimate in there. But first of all, we need to know the party will gain its legitimacy through further reform and continuing the economic growth.
So what you're saying is that the term, now we're getting an answer, that reform has replaced communism as the new kind of ideological cover. So we say we're pursuing, instead of pursuing the goal of communism, now we are just pursuing the goals of reform.
Yeah, that's why I said that I provide a political economy framework.
Okay.
Or reform that's is not an ideology framework.
Reform. Okay. Arthur.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Arthur Kroeber from Dragonomics in Brookings. I have a question for Professor Tsai. We're anticipating that the government will soon release a kind of a blueprint for the next stage of urbanization, and that this will be one of the most important early policy announcements of the new government. I wonder if you could share with us any understanding that you might have of what that policy is likely to contain, and whether it is likely to address some of these issues like hukou reform that you think are important from your perspective.
Yeah. If you read the report of 18th National Congress of the party, you would notice that there were some new expressions well written. First of all, it's not only urbanization. It's to turn the migrant workers into permanent, legitimate urban residents. That's very important. Secondly is the full coverage of public services
for all citizens with or without urban hukou. So if you put all this together, that means the new type urbanization means the urbanization with people-centered urbanization. Probably, I think maybe some local government would think, oh, urbanization is a very, very good opportunity for us to further investment in infrastructure construction or land development. But I believe Premier Li Keqiang well means about the migrant-centered urbanization. And I believe that's that's more than important to support the further that's reform itself, but to support the further growth from the supply side. So that's, I believe, the very right way to go.
Okay, thank you. Now, we only have time for one more question. I'll give it to this person here in the front.
Thank you. My name is Shi Wei Yan, and I'm from George Washington University. I'd like to ask Professor Wang Jizi a question about, you mentioned that a public diplomacy, and what would you suggest Chinese government to better communicate its intention to the public audience, like the U.S. audience? Thank you.
Well, actually, I'm not only thinking about how to do diplomacy toward U.S. audiences, but also how we have organizations, what we call social organizations, existing in China. We don't call them NGOs. But the government is working on U.S. Congress and U.S. Businesses and many others. Our embassy here is very active. But I'm also thinking about horizontal connections between the two societies. Many people come here, like ourselves, like Cai Xin, they are doing their public diplomacy. This is very effective. So I like that idea, and I think we should always be part of it. Cai Xin is working on the U.S. population, and the embassy people are also working, and they have parallel roles to play, and no one can replace they cannot replace each other.
Okay, I think with that question, we should conclude our last panel. Clearly, we don't have enough time to address all the reform agenda issues and the challenges, but this is a conversation I think will continue. So let's thank our panelists for their contributions.